This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. From the North American Review, Chapters from My Autobiography, Chapter 24, by Mark Twain. From Susie's Biography of Me, 1885-86. Mama and Papa have returned from Monteiro, and they have had a delightful visit. Mr. Frank Stockton was down in Virginia and could not reach Monteiro in time, so they did not see him. And Mrs. Mary Mapes Dodge was ill and couldn't go to Monteiro, but Mrs. General Custer was there, and Mama said that she was a very attractive, sweet-appearing woman. Dictated October 9th, 1906. Monteiro was situated high up in the Catskill Mountains in the center of a far-reaching solitude. I do not mean that the region was wholly uninhabited. There were farmhouses here and there at generous distances apart. Their occupants were descendants of ancestors who had built the houses in Rip Van Winkle's time or earlier, and those ancestors were not more primitive than were this posterity of theirs. The city people were as foreign and unfamiliar and strange to them as monkeys would have been, and they would have respected the monkeys as much as they respected these elegant summer resorters. The resorters were a puzzle to them. Their ways were so strange and their interests so trivial. They drove the resorters over the mountain roads and listened in shamed surprise at their bursts of enthusiasm over the scenery. The farmers had had that scenery on exhibition from their mountain roosts all their lives and had never noticed anything remarkable about it. By way of an incident, a pair of these primitives were overheard chatting about the resorters one day, and in the course of their talk, this remark was dropped. "I was driving a passel of them around about yesterday evening, quiet ones, you know, still and solemn, and all to once they busted out to make your hair lift, and I judged hell was to pay. And what do you reckon it was? Weren't anything but just one of them common damn yaller sunsets." In those days. Tuesday, October 16th, 1906. Warner is gone. Stockton is gone. I attended both funerals. Warner was a near neighbor from the autumn of 71 until his death 19 years afterward. It is not the privilege of the most of us to have many intimate friends, a dozen was our aggregate, but I think he could count his by the score. It is seldom that a man is so beloved by both sexes and all ages as Warner was. There was a charm about his spirit and his ways and his words that won all that came within the sphere of its influence. Our children adopted him while they were little creatures, and thenceforth to the end he was Cousin Charlie to them. He was Uncle Charlie to the children of more than one other friend. without premonition, without a moment's warning. Uncle Remus still lives and must be over 1,000 years old. Indeed, I know that this must be so because I have seen a new photograph of him in the public prints within the last month or so, and in that picture his aspects are distinctly and strikingly geological, and one can see he is thinking about the mastodon and the plesiosaurians that he used to play with when he was young. It is just a quarter of a century since I have seen Uncle Remus. He visited us in our home in Hartford and was reverently devoured by the big eyes of Susie and Clara, for I made a deep and awful impression upon the little creatures who knew his book by heart through my nightly declamations of its tales to them, by revealing to them privately that he was the real Uncle Remus, whitewashed so that he could come into people's houses the front way. He was the bashfulest grown person I have ever met. When there were people about, he stayed silent and seemed to suffer until they were gone. But he was lovely, nevertheless, for the sweetness and benignity of the immortal Remus looked out from his eyes, and the graces and sincerities of his character shone in his face. It may be that Jim Wolfe was as bashful as Harris. It hardly seems possible, yet as I look back 56 years and consider Jim Wolfe, I am almost persuaded that he was. He was our long, slim apprentice in my brother's printing office in Hannibal. He was 17, and yet he was as much as 4 times as bashful as I was, though I was only 14. He boarded and slept in the house, but he was always tongue-tied in the presence of my sister, and when even my gentle mother spoke to him, he could not answer save in frightened monosyllables. He would not enter a room where a girl was. Nothing could persuade him to do such a thing. Once, when he was in our small parlor alone, two majestic old maids entered and seated themselves in such a way that Jim could not escape without passing by them. He would as soon have thought of passing by one of Harris's plesiosaurians, 90 feet long. I came in presently, was charmed with the situation, and sat down in a corner to watch Jim suffer and enjoy it. My mother followed a minute later and sat down with the visitors and began to talk. Jim sat upright in his chair, and during a quarter of an hour he did not change his position by a shade. Neither General Grant nor a bronze image could have maintained that immovable pose more successfully. I mean as to body and wasps in Missouri to come and climb Duchin's legs. Nobody there would ever have known it, but Chin and the wasps and me. There he would have sat until the babies left. When they finally went away, we went upstairs and he took his clothes off, and his legs were a picture to look at. They looked as if they were mailed over with shirt buttons, each with a single red hole in the center. The pain was intolerable. No, would have been intolerable, but the pain of the presence of those ladies had been so much harder to bear that the pain of the wasp stings was quite pleasant and enjoyable by comparison. Jim never could enjoy wasps, but I remember once from Susie's biography of me, 1885-6. Mama has given me a very pleasant little newspaper scrap about Papa to copy. I will put it in here. Thursday, October 11th, 1906. It was a rather strong compliment. I think I will leave it out. It was from James Redpath. The chief ingredients of Redpath's makeup were honesty, sincerity, kindliness, and pluck. He wasn't afraid. He was one of Hussle O'Connell and Brown's right-hand men in the Bleeding Kansas days. He was all through that struggle. He carried his life in his hands, and from one day to another it wasn't worth the price of a night's lodging. He had a small body of daring men under him, and they were constantly being hunted by the Jayhawkers, who were pro-slavery Missourians, guerrillas, modern freelancers. Friday, October 12, 1906. I can't think of the name of that daredevil guerrilla who led the Jayhawkers and chased Redpath up and down the country, and in turn was chased by Redpath. By grace of the chances of war, the two men never met in the field, though they several times came within an ace of it. 10 or 12 years later, Redpath was earning his living in Boston as chief of the lecture business in the United States. 15 or 16 years after his Kansas adventures, I became a public lecturer, and he was my agent. Along there somewhere was a press dinner one November night at the Tremont say the study of myself, for in my individual person, I am the entire human race compacted together. I have found that there is no ingredient of the race which I do not possess in either a small way or a large way, and it is small as compared with the same ingredient in somebody else, there is still enough of it for all the purposes of examination. In my contacts with the species, I find no one who possesses the quality which I do not possess. The shades of difference between other people and me serve to make variety and prevent monotony, but that is all. Broadly speaking, we are all alike, and so by studying myself carefully and comparing myself with other people and noting the divergences, I have been enabled to acquire a knowledge of the human race which I perceive is more accurate and more comprehensive than that which has been acquired and revealed by any other member of our species. As a result, my private and concealed opinion of myself is not of a complimentary sort. It follows that my estimate of the human race is the duplicate of my estimate of myself. I am not proposing to discuss all of the peculiarities of the human race at this time. I only wish to touch lightly upon one or two of them. To begin with, I wonder why a man should prefer a good billiard table to a poor one, and why he should prefer straight cues to crooked ones, and why he should prefer round balls to chipped ones, and why he should prefer a level table to one that slants, and why he should prefer responsive cushions to the dull and unresponsive ones. I wonder at these things because when we examine the matter, we find that the essentials involved in billiards are as completely and exhaustively furnished by a bad billiard outfit as they are by the best one. One of the essentials is amusement. Very well, if there is any more amusement to be gotten out of the one outfit than out of the other, the facts are in favor of the bad outfit. The bad outfit will always furnish 30% more fun for the players and for the spectators than will the good outfit. Another essential of the game is that the outfit shall give the players full opportunity to exercise their bet skill and display it in a way to compel the admiration of the spectators. Very well, the bad outfit is nothing behind the good one in this regard. It is a difficult matter to estimate correctly the eccentricities of chip balls and the slanting table, and make the right allowance for them and secure a count. The finest kind of skill is required to accomplish the satisfactory result. Another essential of the game is that it shall add to the interest of the game by furnishing opportunities to bet. Very well, in this regard, no good outfit can claim any advantage over a bad one. I know by experience that a bad outfit is as valuable as the best one. That an outfit that couldn't be sold at auction for $7 is just as valuable for all the essentials of the game as an outfit that is worth $1,000. I acquired some of this learning in Jackass. balls, and that the player was privileged to extend his inning and keep on playing until he had used them all up. Repeatedly, and that for every 10 strike, he got a prize. We didn't name the prize, it wasn't necessary, as no prize would ever be needed or called for. He started a sarcastic smile, but quenched it according to the etiquette of his profession. He merely regarded that he would like to select a couple of medium balls and one small one, adding that he didn't think he would need the rest. Then he began, and he was an astonished man. He couldn't get a ball to stay on the alley. When he had fired about 15 balls and hadn't yet reached the cluster of pins, his annoyance began to show out through his clothes. He wouldn't let it show in his face, but after another 15 balls, he was not able to control his face. He didn't utter a word, but he exuded mute blasphemy from every pore. He asked permission to take off his coat, which was granted, and then he turned himself loose with bitter determination. And although he was only an infantry officer, he could have been mistaken for a battery. He got up such a volleying thunder with those balls. Presently, he removed his cravat. After a little, he took off his vest, and still he went bravely on. Higgins was suffocating. My condition was the same, but it would not be courteous to laugh. It would be better to burst, and we came near it. That officer was good pluck. He stood to his work without uttering a word and kept the balls going until he had expended the outfit 4 times, making 4 times 41 shots. Then he had to give it up, and he did, for he was no longer able to stand without wobbling. He put on his clothes, bowed us a courteous goodbye, invited us to call up the fort, and started away. Then he came